"Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" The man said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this you have done?"
Lovely. Thank you, David. Owen, can we pop the PowerPoint on? Please. So we're second of our little series that I've called Master Plan. God's Master Plan throughout the Bible. Just giving an overview of how the Bible all fits together. This is the second of however many. Last time, the first one, we looked at Genesis 1 and 2. We looked at creation. We saw, if you were here, that it's all about God. The focus is on God. But there's a second focus, which is on people, on mankind. The pinnacle of his creation. How we were made to be in partnership with God, working with God. Second only to God. He made it all and then he gave it to the first man and woman, Adam and Eve. And he said, right, now you manage it for me. Look after it for me. It is yours to take and enjoy. It is yours to subdue, to bring under control, to make it work for you. Wonderful privilege that people had. Everything was there. Everything that they could possibly have wanted to enjoy. What a wonderful thing. And you know, I'll give you a little foretaste. That's where it's going to go back to as well. That's the end of the story. It's going to go back to that place where everything is good. Everything works well. Look forward to that, don't you? I look at the rubbish that's in this world. I look at the rubbish that we have to put up with. I look at the mess that's our lives, the frustration we have with bodies and minds and, you know, lives that don't work well, the pain that comes to us in so many ways. And oh, I look forward to when God puts it back to how it was originally. Today, we're going to see why it is as it is now. So the title today, having seen paradise created, this is paradise lost. There was just one prohibition, if you remember, that God had given to Adam and Eve. It was that they were not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good. He said, the day you do that, you will die. He set out the consequences very clearly. You will die if you eat from that tree. It was just one tree, just one. You ever felt like saying that to somebody? I ask you just one thing. Don't ask Andrea about it. There was just one thing you were meant to get at the shop. I tell you what. If we have, you know, if there's everything that you can do and there's just one thing, people say, don't do that. You're walking down the road, wet paint, do not touch. Yeah, it's such a silly little thing, isn't it? But you want to touch it. Well, I want to touch it. I think most of us have that level in us. Don't walk on the grass. Well, why not? One thing, but they couldn't manage to stop it. In the situation we read this morning, the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord had made. The serpent, as we discover elsewhere in the Bible, was Satan embodied. So this is Satan, the enemy of God. And I haven't time this morning, and it's not the business in this particular series to look at the origin of Satan, where he came from, how he was there. He was there. That's the point. He was there in the garden. And he said to the woman. Let's have a look, first of all, at Satan's method. Where it went wrong, because we know they broke the command of God. And we're going to look at this and the effects of it. What was Satan's method? It was double-pronged. Firstly, he created doubt and then he appealed. And almost at the same time, he appeals to her sense of pride or to their sense of pride. It says in verse 1, if you've got your Bible open, you notice what he does? He said to the woman, he asks the question, did God really say? Did God really say, you must not eat from any tree in the garden? There's a question. Did he? Sometimes just a question is enough, isn't it, to raise further questions. It's enough to bring doubts in. It seems almost like an innocent enough question. Did he really say that? Doesn't seem very important, does it? It's not earth-shattering. But it was enough to get her mind thinking and wondering. You notice the overstatement in that question as well. Did he really tell you from any tree in the garden? There's an overstatement, wasn't it? God hadn't said that at all. But Satan, like he tends to do, is to overstate the commands of God. Make them more difficult. Make them bigger than they really are. Eve's response is great to start with. She almost doesn't need to think about it. The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat from the trees in the..." We may eat. She did contradict him. She got that bit right. And she corrects him. There's no doubt in her mind that God had not forbidden them to eat from any tree, just the one. But in making that response, I want to suggest to you this morning that she started to do something that was... it just paved the way for what was going to follow. She entered into a conversation with Satan. She entered into this dialogue with him. And that's a dangerous thing to do. You see, Satan is the arch deceiver. He is a liar. And what we learn from this very first interaction with him is that it always ends badly when you start to engage with Satan. The lesson here is to just walk away. Don't entertain him. Do something when you feel yourself getting tempted. And when those thoughts start to come in your mind, walk away from it. You say, well, how can I talk to Satan? How do I get into a dialogue? Because you might think, well, I don't actually talk to him in that way. Well, you know, when you even start to think about temptation, when you start to wonder whether, and you just start to give it time, you might not see Satan sitting on your shoulder, you might not feel him breathing down your neck, but you can be sure he'll be somewhere in there. And it starts with yourself, but he will be encouraging it. And the more you think about it, you dwell on it, you think, well, maybe I could get away with it. And you make excuses and you start to have kind of this internal dialogue. James in the Bible, in the New Testament, says something about this. He says, temptation comes from our own desires. And see, he doesn't say from Satan, he says from our own desires. But Satan will use our desires. He will use your desires, the natural things, the things that come into your mind. He will use those. Temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. These desires give birth to sinful action. So it starts in the mind. But what's in the mind when you give those desires time and thought and effort? They will work themselves out. We're mature enough, we're old enough. We know this is the way it works, isn't it? We know, we've just experienced. And then sin is allowed to grow, it gives birth to death. For Eve, her conversation with Satan was only ever going to end badly. Without realizing it, and probably in all innocence, she adds something. She herself now adds something to God's command. He'd said, don't eat. That's all he'd said. Did you notice what she said in her response to Satan? She said that they shouldn't touch it either. You start to see a downward step. Satan has overstepped it. He said, did he really say you can't eat from any tree? Now she's doing it. That we shouldn't touch it, we shouldn't eat it or touch it. God had never said that they weren't to touch. He just said you weren't to eat it. And that's exactly what Satan wants us to do. He always wants to make God seem harsher than he is. He always wants to make his commands and his will and his rules and his laws that are there for our good, he will want to take them and turn them and make it look as if God is a killjoy, that he wants to stop our fun and our enjoyment. And he'll never contradict a person when they start to misrepresent God and when we start to say things that God has not said. It serves his intention, it serves his desires of appealing to our pride and to Eve's pride. You see, what was created here was this thing from Satan as he dialogues with her. He says, you will not surely die, in verse 4, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. And you'll be like God. Eve, what he's really wanting to do, he wants to keep you down. He wants to stop you from being the you that you can be. He wants to stop your enjoyment. He wants to keep you blind. He wants to keep you trapped. He wants to keep you restricted. You're better than that. You deserve more than that. You've got dignity. It's not fair that he should keep you down. And you can just kind of start to feel what's going on in this dialogue. As he appeals to her self-interest, starts to get her to think about putting self first. What would be better for her? Well, yeah, actually, why shouldn't I know? It would be good to know what is right and wrong. It would be good to have those other things. Actually, I'm not sure that it is, that God is fair. If I do this, then it's going to... How many of us have rationalized with temptation like that in our own lives? If I do this, then good will come out from it, whatever it might be. If I do this, then I'll understand people. Oh, man, this is the thing that I struggled with at times. I still do, I guess. If I do this, then it will show that Christians are cool. It will show that it's all right to be a Christian. You haven't got to be whatever, whatever, whatever. It's really hard for young people, but I think it's something that we can all fall into in a little way. This is just one example of where we rationalize doing something that we probably ought not to do because we think good will come out of it. You can have your own illustrations and examples of that, I'm sure. Creating the doubt, appealing to her uncertainty, he rams home his advantage, and then he directly contradicts what God has said. In verse 5 and 6, you will not surely die. God has said the day you eat, you will die. You will not surely die, the serpent tells the woman. And so this seemingly simple, innocent conversation was all it took. And the fruit that had been there, which probably she'd not given a second thought to before, took on a certain attraction. And she starts to look at it, and suddenly it starts to look so appetizing, so good, so desirable. We find in verse 6, if she thinks about the advantages for her, all that she would get, all that she would enjoy from eating it, her thought now was not for God, but for herself. And so she takes of the fruit and she ate it, it says in verse 6. The first person to feel the rush and the thrill of taking and tasting the forbidden fruit. Forbidden fruit tastes good, doesn't it? Let's be honest. Forbidden fruit tastes good. To start with, it will always leave a bitter taste. And that is exactly what it did for Adam and Eve. Satan's method was to create doubt. It was to appeal to her pride, and it's what he always does. The result was catastrophic. Firstly, like Satan has said, their eyes were opened. But not to see what they thought they would see. Oh, cover yourself up for goodness sake, woman. They made themselves some clothes. That wasn't what they'd bargained for, was it? Suddenly what has seemed so good, so wonderful, so attractive, is cover yourself up. They began to feel things they hadn't felt, experience things they hadn't experienced, but they weren't good. Having thrown off the Creator and His rule, they're introduced to the delights of sin. And all the kinds of change for the worse, the new dynamics immediately come into play. Their relationship with one another changed for the worse. Verse 7, the eyes of both of them were open. They realized they were naked. They fashioned some clothes. They became self-conscious. They became embarrassed. The openness they'd had with each other was gone. The trust they'd had was broken. They make clothes to hide behind. That's why people put clothes on, to hide behind, to give them privacy. Something's gone on in their minds. Their minds have changed. It wasn't what they'd bargained for. Their relationship with God had changed for the worst. Not only do they hide from each other behind, they hide from each other behind the clothes, but they hid from God behind the trees. Not out of embarrassment, but for the first time they experienced a new and uncomfortable feeling. In verse 10, I heard you in the garden, said Adam, and I was afraid. For the first time they start to fear, to experience fear. This was far from the wonderful eye-opening that Satan had promised them. And then the blame game started. In verse 12, what have you done? Who told you? And the man said, the woman you put here with me, she gave me some of the fruit and I ate it. Well, it was the woman's fault. And when he goes to the woman, well, what have you done? It was his fault. It was Satan's fault. The blame game. Funny how when things go wrong, it's always someone else's fault, isn't it? It's always another person's fault, or it's God's fault. What we see here is the origins of the human response to sin and the cause of so much trouble. Excuses, blaming someone else. Everything that's wrong, it's always somebody else's fault. It's the government's fault. It's the school's fault. It's my parents' fault. Oh, it's my genes. It's my husband's fault. It's my wife's fault. It's God's fault. It's Satan's fault. It's anybody's fault but my own. We rationalize sin. So we remove our sense of responsibility and guilt. You look around the world today and you find it over and over and over again. It's always somebody else's fault rather than people taking responsibility for the bad decisions they've made. The Bible doesn't allow us to pass the buck so easily, though. Eve was tempted, but she didn't have to do it, did she? Sure, Adam was tempted, but he didn't have to eat. He didn't have to take the apple. It was their choice. And we get tempted, but we don't have to do and follow those temptations of our mind. Ultimately, the buck stops with us. I can't blame Adam for the things I do wrong, even though I'm born with a sinful nature. You're born with a sinful nature. We can't blame others because at the end of the day, we make the choice, don't we? It's down to me. I make that choice. Sin is my choice. This is a really important thing in the Bible, personal responsibility, not passing the buck, but we see the origin of it right back near the beginning. We've seen the method, we've seen the result, and then we see the judgment that God pronounced on them. The second part, the part that we didn't read this morning. We've seen that there were kind of just consequences that happened because of it, but there were, if we'd have read on, you know, I would encourage you to read this section. There were specific things that God said would happen as a result of their rebellion against him, as a result of their selfishness. The relationship that had changed, that they experienced, that they put on their clothes, that was confirmed by God. And he said, it's always going to be this way. In verse 16, he says, you will, at the end of that, you will, your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. I'm not going to go into the specifics of that. We dealt with that a few months ago when we were looking at the relationship of men and women. I'm not going to go into exactly what it is, but it's clear that there's a breakdown in the relationship. And he says, that is the way it's going to be. It's not going to work as I intended it to. Rivalry would be part and parcel of everyday life. It's not to say it's always going to be the case, but it would be typical of the relationships between men and women. So the relationships have changed forever. set in stone. Creation was changed. In verse 17, to Adam, God said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree that I commanded you, you must not eat. Cursed is the ground because of you. The ground is cursed. Creation, nature changed as a result of it. The land would now have weeds as well as plants. Control of creation would become difficult. Ecologically, things got out of kilter because of sin at the beginning. What we see in creation goes back to this. This is what was happening. It was meant to be perfect. But when sin came, it didn't just affect people, it affected the physical realm as well. Suffering became part and parcel of life. To the woman, he said, verse 16, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. Women, you want to know where it came from? Well, this is where it is. The pain, with pain you'll give birth to children. Pain became part of life. The husband is going to have to work hard to produce the through painful toil, he says. Painful toil, as he speaks to Adam. You will get the fruit of the ground and you'll eat all the days of your life. Suffering, putting bread on the table, childbirth, daily living was going to take effort. It was going to be hard. It wasn't just going to happen. Isn't it ironic that these two things, which should have given greatest pleasure, family and work, now became the source of pain, suffering, and struggle? Death became the only certainty in life. In verse 19, by the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Trouble, effort, work would mark life, and then you'll die. What a wonderful message that is, isn't it? And has it ever changed? The original intent from God was for mankind, for people, human beings, Homo sapiens, to be immortal on earth, enjoying a paradise that God had made, working with him, sharing with him. When they disobeyed him, it changed everything. Everything broke down. It brought decline and death. People say, why is the world as it is? Here we've got the origin of the answer. Not only would we die, but the separation from God was confirmed. At the end of the chapter, he describes how they're sent out from the garden. And a guard is put on the gate so they could not go back in. In other words, they weren't allowed to get back to the tree of life. Because had they have taken from the tree of life, they would have stayed as they were forever. The garden represents the presence of God. They are sent away from him, separated from God. That's a bleak story, isn't it? And yet, in the midst of it, and with this we finish, in the midst of it, there are these little glimpses of hope. They were sent out of the garden so they couldn't go back to eat from the tree of life, because otherwise they would have stayed like it. They would have stayed in a place of perpetual death and separation. God keeps them from that so that there might be a chance, there might be the opportunity that things could change in the future. And we will follow the story through and we will see what God did to bring that change in the provision of Jesus and the Savior so that things might change. He also says in these curses at the end of it, we've seen what he said to Adam and Eve, but he also spoke to Satan. He said, cursed are you above the livestock and all the wild animals. You'll crawl on your belly. You will eat dust all your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between her offspring and yours. And he will crush your head. You will strike his heel. You will hurt him, but he, the offspring, and that's the key thing, because that is what we're going to trace through the rest of the story. The rest of the Bible story is about this offspring that would crush the head of Satan. There would come a time when this serpent, this evil one, this malevolent force, this Satan that's a liar and deceiving and as opposed to all that God is, there's coming a day when his head will be crushed. So even in this story of catastrophe, paradise lost, there is this little glimmer that things will get better. And we will, after a little bit further looking at the consequences, we will start to pick that thread and we will follow it through the Bible and see how the thread becomes the story, the big picture. One last thing, then we're done. Time is gone. We all get tempted like Adam and Eve, don't we? We all get tempted. We who are the people of God, we've been saved, we've been rescued. As a consequence, we want to do what's right, don't we? We want to serve God, we want to honor him, we don't want to do those things. What can we do to help us make the right choices? The thing that Adam did with Eve was to get her to take her eyes off God, to focus on the negatives. You know, the one thing that we can do to help ourselves is to focus on him, to live our lives focused on him. Remember the sunflower that I brought in a couple of weeks ago, and how the sunflower, as it grew, it kept its eye on the sun. That's what we should do. That's what we need to do. Look at Jesus. And so, music team, if you come and join us, we're going to sing a song at the end here to wrap up our service. It's an old song, very old, traditional song. It's about keeping our eyes on Jesus, fixing our eyes on him. Turn your eyes upon Jesus.